Thanks for joining us for this archive of our Documents in Detail webinar for Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. The focus of today's program was Calvin Coolidge's speech on the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, in which he gave some comments and analysis of the meaning of the Declaration when it was written, over time, and how it was relevant in the 1920s, almost 100 years ago, and compared it against some of the other political trends and ideas of the time. We were joined by Dr. John Moser, professor of history at Ashland University, as our moderator, and Dr. Rob McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy, and Dr. Greg Schneider of Emporia State University. Our last Documents in Detail program for the 2019-2020 school year will take place on Wednesday, May 30th, always at 7 p.m. Eastern. The focus of that program will be Herbert Hoover's 1932 speech before the election, which he used to respond to what turned into the New Deal, the policy proposals that his electoral opponent FDR was putting forth. And Hoover gives a response to and a warning about where those programs, according to his ideas, might lead. So we look forward to you joining us on that live program. You can find out information about it at tah.org/programs/webinars. And that'll be our last Documents in Detail program for the 2019-2020 school year.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is John Moser, professor of history and chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. Welcome to another episode of Documents in Detail, Teaching American History's webinar series, in which we bring together thoughtful scholars to have a conversation about historically important documents. We encourage all of you joining us today to participate in that conversation by submitting questions via the chat box. We will try to get to as many of your questions as possible. Within the next week, you will receive an email with a link to request a certificate of participation, as well as a link to the archived video and audio from today's program. The speeches, letters, and other writings that we're using for this year's webinars are all drawn from our book, 50 Core American Documents. Those documents are also available at the Ashbrook Center's voluminous document database located at teachingamericanhistory.org. The subject of tonight's program is Calvin Coolidge's speech on the 150th anniversary of the Declaration.
Make sure to take a look at our other webinars upcoming and archives at tah.org.
Dr. Gregory Schneider, professor of history at Emporia State University, and Dr. Robert M.S. McDonald, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Greg, Rob, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, John.
Let's start out by talking about why this document is worth including. If you're in a volume of 50 core documents for all of U.S. history, why does this deserve to be in that rarefied company?
So I can be snarky and say because you had to include something from Coolidge, but that's not the reason. That's part of it. Coolidge has a lot of interesting speeches. I was the point man for a while for Calvin Coolidge studies at Teaching American History until they dropped it, it seemed. Even got to go to Plymouth Notch and see where he took the oath of office. But what struck me in his writings, I mean, he's obviously not Lincoln in his prose, no doubt. But what strikes me is his consistency in approaching, a lot of the topics of the founding, especially. And of a lot of anniversaries during his tenure in office. I think there was the anniversaries of Gettysburg as well, if I'm not mistaken, and something else that occurred that there are speeches on. And he relates them very, very ably to consistently to the principles and especially the religious principles of the founding. And for this reason, I think, especially following on Woodrow Wilson, and his denigration of the Declaration of Independence and especially of natural rights perspective, I think Coolidge is well worth including to kind of get a 20th century perspective that fits with what the founding principles of the nation were and defending them.
Okay. Rob, care to add to that?
Yeah, I would add in some ways this represents the broad attempt of Harding and Coolidge to return to normalcy. I mean, there had been a lot of change in American politics, a lot of change in American thinking about politics during the progressive era. And I think in a way, Coolidge is standing athwart history, yelling stop with this speech. And he is urging for a return to, in some ways, the fundamentalism of you know, the American project, looking at the Declaration of Independence, looking at the Constitution, giving them their due reverence. Whereas we know that people like Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt had some real concerns and criticisms regarding the American founding. And I think, like a lot of progressives, thought that the world had changed so much that those foundational documents no longer possessed the utility that they might once have.
It's disappeared.
I don't know. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
I can hear you now.
Good. All right. Somewhere along the line, the button to unmute myself disappeared from my screen, so I had to find an alternative. Sorry. Can either of you or both of you provide us with a little bit of context for this speech?
Well, I could begin. Wilson was speaking in Philadelphia, of course, you know, on July 5th, 1926. So this is the 150th anniversary of American independence. He's speaking at the Sesquicentennial International Exposition, which was essentially a world's fair that was being held just outside of Philadelphia. And he was speaking to an audience of 200,000 people. So, I mean, this is really a massive event. I've read that there was an 80-foot-tall replica of the Statue of Liberty. There was a replica of the Liberty Bell that was covered in 26,000 light bulbs. You know, there were rides, there were concerts, there were games, you know, all sorts of different amusements. And I think in many respects, this is sort of one of the pinnacle moments of the sesquicentennial throughout the United States. So this is a big event, and this is a really big speech.
Rob, do you know if it was on the radio?
That's a good question. I assume it must have been, but you know, the idea was there were 200,000 people in his audience, which is itself, you know, really an incredible amount.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I went back through this speech, I simply made note of some particular passages that I think are important. And if it's all right with you, I thought I would go through, share some of those and get your comments on why he uses a particular turn of phrase, what his meaning is, et cetera. Let me find that. Okay. So he, you know, he goes in, we celebrate the birthday of America, fine. But then we go into about the third paragraph. And it is not so much then for the purpose of undertaking to proclaim new theories and principles that this annual celebration is maintained, but rather to reaffirm and reestablish those old theories and principles which time and the unerring logic of events have demonstrated to be sound. Why include that verbiage? Why draw this distinction between old theories and new ones?
I think it gets back to something Rob said at the beginning. I mean, this is the project of kind of reaction against progressivism, certainly, that both Harding and Coolidge represent, and not in a nasty way and in a sense of a partisan way, but in a way of kind of reaffirming what was right about American history, principles, and other things, and rejecting the historicism, German historicism, Wilson and others, that was placed into their interpretation of the founding documents. And, you know, Wilson had given a speech on 4th of July of 1918, so we're still at war, and he says, liberty does not consist in mere general deliberative deliberations of the rights of men. It consists of the translations of those deliberations into defiant action, or definite action, sorry. Can't read what I'm writing. So, I mean, think of it, think of what Coolidge is kind of representing in this statement, a reaffirmation of the principles of the founding, their extrapolation into religious principles, into sacred ground, as opposed to what Wilson did, which was denigrate them at every opportunity. Even going back into Wilson's, you know, work as a scholar, I did that quite frequently.
Mm-hmm. Rob?
To piggyback off of what Greg said, I mean, you know, we oftentimes think of Woodrow Wilson's 1911 speech to the Jefferson Club of Los Angeles, and he really downplayed the theory of the Declaration of Independence. He says that, you know, the rhetorical introduction is the least part of it. And he, you know, asked people to ignore the preface, the extraneous stuff about all men being created equal with certain inalienable rights. And I think what Calvin Coolidge is doing here is he's trying to, in some way, restore American reverence for the Declaration, for its central principles, for the political theory of the document. And, you know, we know that Calvin Coolidge, he's, you know, kind of a cool guy because he has it in his heart to admire both Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. But I just read an excellent conference paper that is written by David Alvis and you, John Moser, which will be presented at the upcoming Sons of the American Revolution conference, Interpreting Independence, the Declaration Through the Generations. And in your coverage of this period, you mentioned that Coolidge admired Jefferson for a number of different reasons. But one quote from your paper that really stood out to me was, in his theory that the people should manage their government and not be managed by it, he was everlastingly right. And so I think in some ways, the Declaration speaks to Calvin Coolidge because it is a liberating document. It is a document that makes clear that government, if it is going to be just, is going to represent the consent of the governed. And I think in a lot of ways, it militates against this progressive idea that people with expertise, that bureaucrats, should have a greater ability to steer the ship state.
Well, you know, I'll say that last summer when Jeremy and I kind of laid out the season of documents in detail, I was sure to put this document in because I knew that I would be writing a paper that would touch on it and that the speakers would have. Of course, that's absolutely not true. I appreciate the shout out there. Of course, you know, we're not really here to talk about Wilson, but I think you can't help but address the distinction between the way Wilson and Coolidge treat Jefferson. As you point out, Rob, in a way, Coolidge is outside of his usual element in praising Jefferson, because that's not a thing that Republicans did, certainly not in the late 19th century. Teddy Roosevelt had no regard for Jefferson and barely talked about the Declaration. But with Wilson, as a Democrat, he's got to play nice with Jefferson because he's the Democrats are still celebrating at this point Jefferson and Jackson Day dinners. They're still looking to Jefferson as founder of their party. So a Democrat can't diss Jefferson, but instead Wilson, there's certainly subtle denigration going on. And I think you both touched on the ways that he kind of subtly digs at it. But it's in the context of trying to enlist Jefferson in the cause of progressive reform. And that is what Coolidge, it seems to me, is reacting against.
John, can I add something on that? I think please. In many respects, it's not so much Coolidge praising Jefferson, but praising the roots of liberty and the roots of individual rights within the American tradition, the colonial tradition, the religious tradition, especially. I mean, talking about Thomas Hooker, Reverend John Wise. I mean, the more I read this, I think I assign it every semester in my class, America Between the Wars. It's in there, I believe. Should be, better be. I can't remember, but I will put it in if it's not. But I've assigned it many times. And what strikes me all the time is reading that, and, you know, going back to the Dutch and going back to this, you know, the 1500s and finding the principles of liberty within that, an inherited tradition, but it's improved upon in the thinking of religious men in the colonial period. And it really has very little to do with Jefferson's just recapsulating those principles in some respect.
Yeah, that's a great point. Rob, you care to amplify that? Or?
Well, I mean, I agree, though. I mean, it seems as if in this speech, Calvin Coolidge is, in many respects, making the point that America has been so successful, not only because of its political foundations, not only because of the constitution of the government, but also the constitution of the people. One of the lines that appealed to me most of all, and I'm looking for it now, but I'll paraphrase. I could quote it directly. He says, "The Continental Congress was not only composed of great men, but it represented a great people." And just in the paragraph before that, he's speaking of the American Revolution, and in pretty visceral language, he says, "It brought no scum to the surface, for the reason that colonial society had developed no scum. The great body of the people were accustomed to privations, but they were free from depravity. If they had poverty, it was not of the hopeless kind that afflicts great cities, but the inspiring kind that marks the spirit of the pioneer. The American Revolution represented the informed and mature convictions of a great mass of independent, liberty-loving, God-fearing people who knew their rights and possessed the courage to dare to maintain them."
Yeah, I had flagged that passage as something that we ought to talk about more. Why emphasize that? How does that serve Coolidge's larger purpose here?
Well, if I could take the first stab at it, it actually called to mind sort of the historiography of the day. And, you know, historiography is something that is probably pretty far removed from much of our modern political discourse. But the historians back then were largely writing for an informed, educated audience, for regular, smart people. And, you know, among the most famous works to emerge from that general period is Frederick Jackson Turner's discussion of the frontier and the closing of the frontier in 1890, you know, when the Census Bureau said that basically all of America had been populated. And Turner posited that, you know, maybe Americans were losing something with the closing of the frontier, that the act of expanding west had sort of shaped the American character. And that implicit in his message, I think, is the anxiety that as we become increasingly urbanized, we'll lose some of that rugged individualism that had marked us as a people. I think it's fair to say that Coolidge was certainly aware of the frontier thesis, but in a way he's trying to rescue America from it. And he's trying to point out that at their heart, Americans are a good people, a decent people, the hardworking people like those among whom he grew up in Vermont.
Greg, care to add to that?
Yeah, I'd also add that the quote that Rob had about the poverty and it brought the revolution, brought no scum to the surface for the reason that colonial society developed no scum. I was thinking in terms of Coolidge's kind of, he's not a red hunter by any means, but certainly Coolidge's view perhaps filtered through the consequences of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, perhaps other revolutions in Latin America in the early 20th century. I mean, he would send troops into Nicaragua, I believe that same year, for instance, to counter revolutionary elements that to him were not reflective of the people of the colonial American experience. And, you know, certainly you can, in a modern sense, he's not talking about slavery. He's not talking about the things that are left out of the struggle towards individual freedom. But in many respects, he is very hostile to the modern revolutionary sense, which maybe began with the French, not with the American. The American Revolution is pure. Everything since then has been a betrayal of what revolutions are should be. And they're not based on principle. They're not based on individual consent of the governed. They're based on resurrect, you know, totally revolutionizing society in a way that Coolidge would find despicable.
Yeah, and you know, although the Red Scare would have been over by, you know, by several years at this point, certainly there is still a fear of radicalism out there that might be reflected in this. Nevertheless, he does talk. Let me go back and find this quote. He says, "It is not here necessary to examine in detail the causes which led to the American Revolution. In their immediate occasion, they were largely economic." And he goes on to explain that. So if this is really a set of economic grievances at heart, then why is the Declaration of Independence so important?
Well, I think this brings us to, you know, I hate to keep going back to historiography because it usually makes people's eyes glaze over. But we should keep in mind that Charles Beard wrote his Economic Origins of the Constitution in 1913. And 2 years after that, he published a book called The Economic Origins of Jeffersonian Democracy. So, you know, part of progressive historiography was to look for sort of economic incentives behind people's actions. In many ways, you know, I think this undermined, in the eyes of many, the American Revolutionary Project, because some Beardians sort of reduced the rhetoric of the American Revolution to mere sloganeering. And I wonder if, in a way, he's bringing this up to then, you know, kind of take it down a notch with his statement that follows, which is, you know, "But the conviction is inescapable that a new civilization had come, a new spirit had arisen on this side of the Atlantic, more advanced and more developed in its regard for the rights of the individual than that which had characterized the old world."
Greg, care to add to that?
I was just going to quote that very line. I mean, I think in many respects he's, and then here is kind of the frontier thesis: life in a new and open country had aspirations which could not be realized in any subordinate position. So, I mean, the emergence of the spirit of individualism, the consent of the governed, the whole, the things that were actually going on in the colonies anyways, in many respects, before the Stamp Act and before the British oppression navigation acts and the like that brought about the revolution, these are the sorts of things he wants to recapture, I think, in order to make his wider point about the spiritual nature of the Declaration and its notion of and its links to natural rights.
Just to remind everyone, we've got 100 and some people out there listening. Feel free to put some questions. Oh, wait a minute. Something just appeared. This is Israel Gibson asks, "You obviously think it's important, wouldn't have made the list otherwise, and have brought up historiography a few times. What's your opinion on how Coolidge's speech and the ideals in it have aged? And has it been a steady curve one way or the other, or has it gone through a series of changes? I ask because one of my joys each year is when my students tackle their president song and album project, and in their research really identify or get into some aspect or belief of one of those deemed a non-giant, like a Taft or Coolidge, especially if they evaluate them differently than they traditionally have been."
I'll take a stab, perhaps. I think you could have seen this perspective maybe muted, certainly historically by the Depression, the New Deal, World War II, the crises of that era. But I think in the consensus era, this kind of idea would have had some, and the consensus historiography of the 50s, 40s and 50s, probably would have had some important bearing. I'm thinking of Daniel Boorstin's book, The Genius of American Politics, which is, you know, the genius of American politics is there's no conflict. And if you look at Coolidge, even the Civil War, I don't think is mentioned, that's the genius of it. We've never had any problems. And in some respects, that book reflects, I think, a lot of what Coolidge is trying to recapture here. And in a way, it's a response of Boorstin and other consensus historians to the progressives as well. So, I mean, progressive historians. I think in this sense, it probably has some specific valence in those in that era, but of course would have been denigrated after the 60s in the new left historiography, and wherever we are today in terms of historiography, every person is their own historian.
Rob?
Yeah, I would add to that maybe by carrying the historiography a little bit further. Of course, after the consensus interpretation of the American Revolution, you have the rise of the small R Republican interpretation of the American Revolution. And what we see there is arguing against the progressives by pointing out that these weren't mere slogans, that instead what you have are people, you know, referring to beliefs and principles that had been important in America for decades prior to the imperial crisis with Great Britain. They weren't just talking about taxation without representation being a bad thing in the 1760s. They were also saying the same thing in the 1720s and the 1730s. And so in a way, that kind of causes Coolidge's take on the newness of this all to be diminished just a bit. I think, you know, he was probably better in his rhetoric and his patriotism than he was in his history, because one of the things that made the American revolutionaries so successful is that they were basing their beliefs, they were basing their argument in things like John Locke's two treatises on government, which helped to establish the legitimacy of the British government after the Glorious Revolution. In other words, the American revolutionaries were representing the principles on which Britain was supposed to be based. And it was Britain's departure from those principles, which they believed necessitated American independence.
This,
Rob, can I ask a question? I'm sorry.
Sure. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, I'm sure it's Bernard Bailyn and certainly Gordon Wood and other scholars of the revolution who've captured that very effectively and well. But I don't know if Coolidge is diminishing that so much. I mean, he's going back to a different tradition that I'm not sure was in. So he's not going back to Lockean liberalism, but to the religious traditions of the fount of the Hooker and Wise and others. And then I'm thinking of Ellis Sandoz's edited book. I think Liberty Fund published it many years ago about religious sermons on behalf of the revolution. That's what this speech always reminds me of a little bit, is that, you know, a lot of that religiosity about the individual and the consent of the governed has been kind of moved away from historiographical traditions. And Coolidge is not so much an originator of that, but he's kind of recapturing it in a little bit. But I'm not an American revolutionary historian, so I'll defer. But I think that ultimately, I think that that's a great point. But I think Coolidge has some stuff in there, maybe not explicitly on the revolution, but on the wider tradition of liberty.
No, I agree. And I think you're right. And I think that, you know, it's interesting. We make sense of the revolution based on what we believe we know about it. And at different times in American history, people have believed that they knew different things. So, you know, Wilson obviously doesn't have access. I'm sorry. Calvin Coolidge obviously doesn't have access to, you know, the historiography of the later 20th century. But I think he probably is reflecting, you know, some of the beliefs that had emerged during the course of the 19th century.
So I want to go back to this paragraph about the Declaration of Independence representing a movement of the people. Now, you both mentioned about this very evocative phrase, brought no scum to the surface. On the other hand, it's not a movement from the top. Revolutions do not come from that direction. It was not without the support of many of the most respectable people in the colonies who were entitled to all the consideration that is given to breeding, education, and possessions. So on the one hand, it's not the people at the very top who brought this about, but it's not the scum at the bottom who are the oppressed and downtrodden who are bringing up who really want to see a social revolution. This seems to be pretty significant, right?
Well, I think so, and I think, you know, Wilson here as a historian is probably not so far off. I mean, America was a land of middling people. Property ownership was very widespread among the white population. You know, the number of people who during the colonial period had the franchise because they possessed an adequate amount of land to qualify for it was very high compared to other parts of the world, including England. Literacy rates were higher in America than virtually anywhere else in the world. And so this really was a unique and I think uniquely prosperous and enlightened place, you know, prior even to 1776.
I would concur with that. I have nothing to add to that. I think the middling sort of the colonists has always been the prized men and people. Going back to the 1600s, if I remember correctly, and the merchants and capital and farmers and those doing that sort of middling occupations were the ones who were the basis of American society, colonial society, and then certainly revolutionary one as well. You know, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. They would consider themselves probably middle class today.
Sure. Yeah. They're not, you know, they're not aristocrat. They're not, you know, hereditary aristocrats, but.
Right.
Yeah. You know, of course, one of the theme that I think you both have already mentioned is how Coolidge wants to show that this is part of an older tradition, right? These aren't theories that have just, Coolidge puts it, great ideas do not burst upon the world unannounced. So there have been plenty of precursors for the ideas that are put forward in the Declaration. But there's something different for Coolidge and uniquely American that sets it apart from the typical revolution directed against an unpopular monarch. Can you say something about this notion of that shows up here? What makes the American Revolution different, that breaks it away even from that long tradition of anti-monarchical thought?
I think he says this towards, I don't know, it's page 12 on the printed version of the speech and on the online too. Again, I keep coming back to his religious sentiments. And so he says about the profound philosophy, no one can examine this record and escape the conclusion that in the great outline of its principles, the Declaration was the result of the religious teachings of the preceding period. So he talks about George Jonathan Edwards. He talks about George Whitefield. He talks about Reverend Wise and Hooker a few pages later. I mean, to Coolidge, it seems that the very basis of individual rights, natural rights philosophy is tied in deeply to the religious elements that existed among the people in the colonies. A lot different than, let's say, the Marxist heritage that produced the Russian Revolution, or every other revolution since then in the 20th century, which was about opposing religion, opposing traditional society. It's a reclamation of those great things about tradition, which is what Coolidge is after here. And that's shown very effectively, I think, by him about the religious elements of the founding.
Rob.
I think that in some ways, while Woodrow Wilson would urge us to ignore the introduction of the Declaration, which he says is merely rhetorical, I think Coolidge sees that the American project is rooted in the introduction of the Declaration of Independence. And certainly God is part of that. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So, I mean, there's a lot going on there. One, we shouldn't miss out on the fact that government has a specific purpose. It's to secure these rights. We should also point out that if it is going to be legitimate, it needs not only to secure these rights, but it also has to derive its powers from the consent of the people. But these rights are a gift from God, right? And they're not invented or bestowed by a government. A government can merely and must secure them.
So we have a question here for Joanne Moretz. In fact, I was just about to ask something similar to this, so I'm really glad she brought it up. How much influence did Coolidge's New England upbringing, especially religious thought, have in developing his frame of thought?
I'm not sure if it, you know, if he was a deeply religious man. I mean, he's a Congregationalist. He's not. He talks very sparingly about his religious faith in his autobiography. It's not exactly. It's a book about 250 pages or less. Kind of big print too. And he talks about the institutions of New England, which I think shaped him, and certainly the church may have been one of them. The meeting hall, you know, the school that he went to, which was, a very small school. And he talks very, for a couple pages in his autobiography, about the school teacher who influenced him more than I think his religious upbringing. So I'm not even sure if it's his immediate religious upbringing, but the sense of New England, Vermont, Massachusetts later as governor, as well as Amherst as governor later, that milieu of the spirit of Americana, I guess, and the principles there that influence him more than direct religious upbringing.
Yeah, Rob, do you have anything to add to that?
I think I agree with everything Greg just said. I mean, it does strike me that in some ways Wilson is a pretty profoundly conservative guy, and I think one aspect of intellectual conservatism is an appreciation for institutions. And the institutions that have stood the test of time, and that maybe not because of theory, but just because of how they work out in practice, bring about a phenomenon that we want to encourage and that we want to develop. So things like town meetings, things like working the land, things like having a vested interest in your community, things like having a vested interest in caring for your neighbors and wanting to promote the good of your community and wanting to promote and protect your reputation as a member of the community. I mean, these are all things that maybe go beyond politics and get us into the realm of civil society, but they're important ingredients to the success of the United States, I think, in Coolidge's estimation.
Is it fair to say that Coolidge is a great believer in what Rousseau might call the civil religion?
I would say yes. And I think that's inculcated, too, in his education, especially at Amherst College, which, you know, it's interesting we're having this talk on Earth Day. Amherst College would see the only religion worth talking about is Earth worship probably today. But 100 years ago when Coolidge was there, it was more or less a religious school. More or less a school that was all male, of course, where Coolidge would have been getting a steady diet of American national history. So this would have been well versed in this of, you know, rhetoric of Greek and Roman history. I'm sure these were the things that would have been taught. And that's the basis for a kind of civil society in the Western tradition. Right. And I think that plays a specific role in his thinking about these events and about the national past.
Rob.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not an expert on Calvin Coolidge. I can't tell you that he was born on the 4th of July, the only president who could make that claim. There were three who passed away on that date. I think he's very much a product of his New England upbringing and America in the second half of the 19th century.
The one anecdote I can think of regarding Coolidge and religion is the story of how his wife was not feeling well, so she didn't go to services on Sunday morning, and he returned with the children, and of course, Grace asked, "Well, what was the sermon about?" And Coolidge's response was, "Sin, he's again it." That may be apocryphal. In any case, Michael Cinziani asks a question. I'm fascinated by Coolidge's strong warnings about keeping America as a Christian nation as a means of preserving the values of equality, liberty, rights of man, etc. Why such an emphasis at that time? And any is there any relevance for today?
Well, I mean, it's a really fascinating question, and I will take a stab at it. Again, not as a scholar of Calvin Coolidge, but as someone who does teach American history, as I suspect many or most of our listeners, do as well. This was after a period of tremendous immigration to the United States. And there really had been a great deal of social change just to the basic composition of the American people. I will say myself as a Catholic that, most of these immigrants were Catholic. And I think a lot of Protestants were somewhat unsettled by that. Certainly American revolutionaries were unsettled by Catholicism. I think it blew the minds of many that they ended up allying themselves with France, which was a Catholic nation, because throughout their colonial history, Catholicism had been associated with tyranny. Catholicism was thought to have been an engine of oppression. It was supposed to condition minds to subservience and top-down hierarchical governance. It's not insane that they would think such things, because England by this point was a Protestant country, and England was really the only nation in the world before the United States which had a limited government, and a government that said at least that it was devoted to the protection of liberty. If kings ruled by divine right elsewhere, and when they were coronated, had a bishop or a cardinal, placed the crown upon their head. In England, it had evolved into a very different sort of system. So maybe that sort of traditional Protestant anxiety about Catholicism is rearing its head in this speech in some way.
Great.
I think it's an age of tumult that both Harding and Coolidge are kind of addressing. If you look at Harding's speeches in the early 20s, he consistently refers to the war. Coolidge less so. The war had left deep scars on the American polity, on society. Certainly you had the Red Scare. You had immigration laws that both Harding and Coolidge support, restrictive laws. Coolidge is a little less supportive of them, but he signs them, the 1924 Act, I should say. I'm not sure if it's so much, it's this kind of idea that Lincoln had begun of a civil religion in some respects, and of presidents necessitating to wrap themselves around that to justify it. I mean, I'm really thinking ahead. I can't remember Teddy Roosevelt using religion too much in his speeches. Certainly Wilson didn't that much. But FDR does quite a bit. And FDR is no Coolidge, right, in terms of his views of limited power, consent, the state. He builds up the administrative state even further with the New Deal. But there's a consistent usage of God, the Bible, biblical phrases, and other things in Roosevelt's speeches throughout the 30s and into World War II. So I think that Coolidge is kind of playing that role. I think he believes it strongly. I have no doubt that he does. But I think this is the necessity of a president to kind of showcase their civil religion now in a modern era.
Teddy Roosevelt, he would like pull biblical quotes out of a grab bag to serve whatever purpose. Like, we stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord is a famous 1912 speech. But yeah, there's not a real sense, if you read his speeches, of deep engagement with the Christian faith either. Either of you care to add anything more to this theme of American religion and Coolidge, or I can go on to other things?
Just one thing more. The American revolutionaries themselves realized that they were engaging in a pretty dicey experiment with self-government. And if we were to succeed as a free people, we needed to be a responsible people. And we need to not allow ourselves to go off the rails in the way that maybe the French Revolutionary subsequently would. And so many people at the time of the American Revolution looked to religion as a bulwark, against temptations that would cause Americans to ruin this great experiment, which we had tried. If people would follow the Ten Commandments, if they would, you know, be moral, if they would do well by their neighbors, that would do a lot if this experiment succeed.
Coolidge spends a lot of time here talking about equality as one of the things that made the principles of the American Revolution different from any other movement to get away from a bad king. He says that placing every man on a plane where he acknowledged no superiors, where no one possessed any right to rule over him, he must inevitably choose his own rulers through a system of self-government. What connection is there between Coolidge's brand of Christianity and the principle of human equality?
Well, he cites Hooker, he cites George Wise, let me find that quote, where he specifically says just that. The consent of the governed comes from the individual, comes from God. I mean, it's a traditional natural rights philosophy, but I think that he, like I said, embodies it in this more Protestant religious, the sermons that played a role here, is on the foundation of authority is laid in the free consent of the people. The choice of public magistrates belongs unto the people by God's own allowance. That was Thomas Hooker in 1638. I mean, if you go forward from that, he's arguing that these sorts of written words were the foundation of the ideas that he traces all the way to the prevalence of the Declaration of Rights, which asserted popular sovereignty in 1776 and inherent natural rights. All men are created equally free and independent, George Mason said. So I think in that sense, he's again tying this back to a tradition which probably is not as well stressed in the 1920s. I mean, you probably have in educational circles, Jefferson and Hamilton and the founders, but you probably aren't getting the sense of religious principles in the founding era that Coolidge is thinking were so crucial to the development of individualism. I don't know if that answers your question, John, but I think that's kind of where he's headed there.
Yeah, I'm inclined to take this back to where Rob was talking, as a Catholic, as am I, about how Catholic Christianity would have been regarded as almost the antithesis of this, because after all, the clergy stand above the laity. And one of the things that was really different about Protestantism was the idea that priesthood of all believers, right? Everyone is equally capable is equal in the eyes of God, which is why we can see the American experiment coming out of a uniquely Protestant brand of Christianity, and B, why Catholicism is regarded through a lot of American history as vaguely sinister. Right. Even in 1928, when Al Smith runs as the Democratic candidate, there are a lot, even within his own party, who think there's no way we're going to vote for a Catholic.
There was an effort, though, in the 20s in cities like Chicago, in the Catholic Church there and the Archdiocese there. George Mundelein, who was the cardinal, wanted to promote Americanization of the church, to move away from specific saint days for the various ethnic groups and the like, and to kind of Americanize more, I wouldn't say secularize the educational process, but move it in a more Americanized direction. So it wouldn't be seen with that suspicion. But of course, we know it always is going forward. Al Smith and others before, well, Al Smith in 1924, more correctly, with the Klan showing up at the convention in New York.
I've long thought that there's an article in this on how Catholicism became patriotic, right? I'm a member of the Knights of Columbus, and patriotism is a huge theme of it, which seems strange when you look at Catholicism, you know, in for a lot of the 19th century. Rob, you care to add anything to this?
Yeah, I mean, just the thought that if you enter any Catholic parochial school, even today, you know, there are two things that you're guaranteed to find in every classroom. One is a crucifix and the other is an American flag. And I think, you know, Catholics, like a lot of immigrants, were assimilated into American society and, you know, came to believe in the foundational principles of the United States with the same degree of enthusiasm as, you know, previous generations that had arrived.
Another question from Jeff. Coolidge sounds like a New England Calvinist. How does he compare to the deists such as Jefferson in applying this religious application of the founders?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think it's fair to describe Thomas Jefferson as a deist. It may not be an exact description, but it's about as Jefferson seemed certainly to believe in God, but he described Jesus as the greatest philosopher who ever lived. Jefferson described himself as a Christian because he was a follower of Jesus's doctrines, and he wrote that Jesus possessed every quality of human greatness, and Jefferson believed never claimed any other sort of quality. So he questioned the divinity of Jesus. He believed that God had created the world, but then kind of stepped back from it and allowed the laws of nature to do their work. So I think, you know, clearly there are kind of religious distinctions between Calvin Coolidge and Thomas Jefferson. But, you know, to invoke a term that has been in vogue of late, I think both appreciated the lived experience that Americans shared. And when I read, you know, some of these passages in Coolidge's speech, one of the passages from Jefferson's writings that comes to mind is in his notes on the state of Virginia. Jefferson writes that those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, that farmers possessed all of the virtues and all of the traits that made them particularly good citizens. They were hardworking. They were economically independent. They were their own bosses. That provided them with a certain degree of intellectual independence. While they could take care of themselves and support themselves and their families, they were almost literally rooted in the soil. So they had a vested interest in promoting the good of their communities. And as I mentioned before, promoting their reputations within their communities. I mean, if a farmer borrows a tool from you, you know that he's going to give it back, because if he doesn't, you'll tell other people and no one will ever loan him a tool again. So anyway, it seems as if both appreciate this kind of rural American ideal. And it's maybe worth noting that in the early 20th century, America is becoming increasingly urbanized. And I think that Coolidge is in some ways making a statement that our rural roots are still important. And the sort of sociology of freedom that exists in America is important to protect.
The only thing I could add to that is that's a great answer, and Rob is the expert on Jefferson. I am not, but I think that I think ultimately what both Jefferson is kind of talking about with the farmers and the perfect citizens is a small R republicanism, of course, that's going to further the ends of the revolution. Coolidge kind of reaffirms that a lot in this speech, and I think in other speeches too. You know, so he doesn't praise the farmers. He vetoes McNary Hagen twice because it's bad policy. It has nothing to do with his hatred of farmers. But he also praises businessmen, of course, at numerous times. But he emphasizes that it's not the robber baron he's praising. It's the businessman's idea of service. And service gets to the sense of you serve your customer, you serve your worker, you serve society. There's this sense of almost a kind of Republican vision with Coolidge and with work and with business too, in a weird way. So if Jefferson had his farmers, Coolidge had his businessmen, and that's kind of a kind of a tie-in between the religious emphasis, service is a religious emphasis, and of small R republicanism as well.
We are running out of time. I think we would be remiss if we did not address what I consider to be the money paragraph of this document. About the Declaration, there is a finality that is exceedingly restful. It is often asserted that the world has made a great deal of progress since 1776, that we have had new thoughts and new experiences, which have given us a great advance over the people of that day, and that we may therefore very well discard their conclusions for something more modern. But that reasoning cannot be applied to this great charter. If all men are created equal, that is final. If they are endowed with inalienable rights, that is final. If governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, that is final. No advance, no progress can be made beyond these propositions. If anyone wishes to deny their truth or their soundness, the only direction in which he can proceed historically is not forward, but backward toward the time when there was no equality, no rights of the individual, no rule of the people. Those who wish to proceed in that direction cannot lay claim to progress. They are reactionary. Their ideas are not more modern, but more ancient than those of the revolutionary fathers. I ask you each to comment on this paragraph.
Greg, you want to go first?
No, go ahead, Rob, and then I'll follow.
Well, I mean, it is the money paragraph. Rhetorically, I think it's incredibly powerful. Because essentially what Calvin Coolidge is doing is he's rooting himself and he's rooting his ideas not so much, you know, standing athwart history yelling stop. He is the history. You know, these ideas of equal rights and limited government and self-government, they are the wave of the future. And they always had been. And those who are trying to wrestle that away from him, you know, the progressives, in other words, the people who think that the world has become so complicated, so complex, so complicated that we need experts to manage things. I think Coolidge would say, no, you're exactly wrong. It's because the world has become more complicated that more than ever now, we need to allow people the flexibility to be free and to make their own choices in this world. So I think it's his way of making that point. And I think it's a really very powerful one.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would also say that Coolidge, kind of in the page after that, goes into this disquisition on the idea that ours is a government of the people. It represents their will. Its officers may sometimes go astray, but that is not a reason for criticizing the principles of our institutions. Kind of maybe a slap at Harding. The real heart of the American government depends upon the heart of the people. It is from that source that we must look for all genuine reform. It is to that cause that we must ascribe all our results. That's, I think, the principles upon which Rob just commented so well. I can't add anything more than that I don't agree. I agree with it, what he said 100%, is that the danger herein lies that what if the people are called upon in the name of that government to do things which undermine those principles? And certainly the tenor of 20th century history has been just that, hasn't it? Starting with the New Deal and going forward. Not to say that it's not principled to do certain actions in times of crisis, but certainly we've come a long way from the disquisition of Calvin Coolidge on the Declaration of Independence and first principles to where we are today with the federal government as a kind of Leviathan.
Can either of you comment on how this speech was received?
It's a great question, John, and I have to be honest with you. I do not know the answer to it.
I wasn't able to find
it either.
Who knows? Well, it's we have about 3 minutes left. I usually end these by asking our speakers. We've got, you know, about 100 people listening here, most of whom we expect are teachers. What's the best argument you can put forward for why they should try to squeeze in this document into their busy curriculum for American history?
Well, I think I'll just take a stab at a quick answer and say that in some ways, you know, happily or sadly, the fact that Coolidge had to make this speech says something about the success of progressivism. The progressive movement was an incredibly successful movement. And in many respects, Coolidge is here struggling to battle back against the progressive movement, to rescue the more foundational principles of the American Revolution and to restore them in center stage of American civic life. So he's trying his mightiest, but of course we know that, you know, after the Coolidge administration, we're soon going to see the Great Depression and then the Second World War and then the Cold War and then the war on poverty and the war on drugs. And, you know, crisis after crisis after crisis is going to be used and leveraged by people to argue for greater government power. And, you know, maybe that's for the good, maybe that's for the bad. It seems pretty clear that Coolidge would think that's for the bad.
Greg.
Along those lines, too, I think it represents a kind of conservative, a kind of a definition of conservatism, if you will, in the 20s, that, you know, there's no conservative movement. There's not an organized movement fighting back against the progressives. There wouldn't be one developed in America really until after World War II. And it's in part because of the reaction to the New Deal and the rise of the state that you get the conservative movement existing. And it's much different than the focus that Coolidge has on the first principles. It's much more focused on reacting to liberalism in some respects, and then crafting policies that could challenge it politically after the 1960s. Coolidge is much more emphasizing the first principles, which he believes have been lost and need to be restored, which is a form of, is a kind of a conservatism that unfortunately always gets kind of pushed to the side throughout the 20th century.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of our panelists, Greg and Rob, as well as our participants for the questions. As a reminder, you will be receiving an email within the next week. That email will include a link for a certificate of participation. It will also contain a link to the archived webinar. We hope you will share that link with your colleagues and share it on social media. Get it out there to as many people as possible, please. If you have enjoyed tonight's webinar, please consider taking an online graduate course in our Master of Arts in American History and Government program. Both Greg and Rob teach in that program. I do all the time. You can find more information about our course offerings, as well as all sorts of resources for teachers at teachingamericanhistory.org. Our next Documents in Detail webinar, and that will be our last one until August, will take place on Wednesday, May 13th. When our topic will be Herbert Hoover's 1932 campaign speech, Consequences of the Proposed New Deal. Joining me to discuss it at that time will be Joseph Postel of the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs and Abby Lynn Sellers of Azusa Pacific University. We look forward to seeing you all back here on May 13th. Thank you all and have a good night.
Thanks again for joining us for this webinar. Make sure to take a look at our other webinars upcoming and archived at tah.org/programs/webinars.